Welcome to this episode of the Superyacht Laundry podcast. It's been a while, listeners, but I'm back with a bang. We've got a great set of episodes coming up. But today's episode, I am very pleased to be joined by the ladies from Ocean Legal, Lucy Goff and Jenny Harris. How are you both doing, ladies, today?
Yeah, we're good, thank you. Yeah, and yourself?
Well, thanks.
Yeah, I'm good. Like I said, I'm a bit out of practice with the podcast. It's been a while. Hopefully Ria will start talking to me again because I haven't done an episode because I'm a terrible person. Terrible. But things have been going on. Obviously, we've had an event and we've had, I've got the survey. Obviously, you guys were fantastic and sponsored our women's event. And it was the first time I got to meet both of you properly. Just quickly, like where, you know, obviously you guys, have you always worked in the maritime industry? How did you guys get together? Let's go back to the beginning before we get into the nitty gritty legal stuff.
Yeah. So not necessarily in the super yacht side, but I've always sailed. And it was actually through sailing that I ended up doing law. So one summer, whilst teaching sailing, I taught the most fantastic barrister. She is an absolute powerhouse now, a lady called Jo Delahunty. And I was off to uni to do history and didn't really have a plan after that. And she said, oh, have you thought about doing law? And I really hadn't, but I went and did some work experience with her. And as I say, she is inspirational. And the work that she does more in the family law setting is amazing. I thought, wow, okay, maybe I want to do this, but I'm not sure emotionally I could deal with family law 24/7. So after my degree, I did some other different work experience and I found out you could do marine law. So that sounds an awful lot more interesting than writing wills or buying property. So that's how I kind of fell into it. And I applied to do my training contract at a firm that Jenny was already working at. And they have a marine team. So I went and did my training at the firm and then qualified into the marine team where Jenny was working as well. So that's where we started working together.
Jenny, how did you end up working in marine law? Or did you get sucked in like most people do? It's like this is the marine vortex that never lets you out.
Yeah, so when I first qualified as a solicitor, I worked in a commercial property firm and it was a lovely firm, great partners, really good career progression. But I just couldn't see myself writing leases for the rest of my life.
It's not the most exciting law.
It's not the most exciting. I mean, somebody's got to do it and it's really important. But I was in no real rush to get out. But just because I just couldn't see myself doing that forever, I just had to look around for something that looked a bit more interesting. And there was a vacancy at the firm Lucy mentioned for a marine lawyer. And I thought, oh, that sounds fun. And literally just got into it that way.
It's quite funny, isn't it? Like, because I remember, you know, when I was working out what I wanted to do at uni, similar to yourself, like history, like philosophy, something quite interesting. Then you realise there's no jobs at the end of that necessarily. And then law, although it's very technical, it's very historic. You know, it's quite interesting where all the law comes from and everything else. But I am at the generation Ally McBeal. Like, she just made it so much more interesting. Do you know what I mean? And there was another American like court case thing and it just always made it so dramatic. And you're like, oh, it must be really amazing to be a lawyer all the time. And that's not the case, is it? It's not like that, hardly at all.
No, it's not like that. But I think we're really lucky in the area that we work in because usually when you train as a lawyer, you're put into a box. You're either a contentious lawyer, you deal with disputes, or a non-contentious lawyer, you deal with contracts or sales and purchases. But our specialism is a sector specialism. So we work across all of those areas. We'll do sale and purchase. We'll do finance transactions. We'll do litigation. We'll do commercial contracts. And with that, we're working with banks. We're working with owners. We're working with all kinds of marine businesses, insurance companies. So it's really varied. And I think that why you don't have the drama of a TV program most days. Some days we do.
Exactly.
It's really boring.
Don't burst my bubble. I was expecting Robert Downey Jr. to walk into your office. You know, back in the day, he was hot, like really hot. You're just expecting him to stroll in and like, but no, it's quite interesting you say that because obviously it's, you know, you've probably got the best of all worlds, haven't you? Like it's super varied, although you've got just, you know, it is law. Whereas a lot of other law, it is just stay 100% in your lane all of the time.
In your lane, at your desk. And, you know, we do a lot of time where we're not at our desks, and that is really enjoyable as well, obviously.
Well, when you get to spend 45 minutes at Palmer, Jenny, yeah. Spend the rest of the time in a hotel room. Yeah. So obviously, you know, Super Yacht Laundry, we are focusing on women's and women's issues, and a lot is coming up at the moment. Obviously, like I said, you sponsored our event that we had, and we released the survey. I know why I wanted to talk to you guys, because with the survey focusing so heavily on reporting, understanding the processes on board, really trying to get what I want the survey to do is get a clear picture of where the holes are, which clearly women on board are falling through. That's why I wanted to talk to you guys, because I do think, you know, legally it's going to be, you know, perhaps the end of this year and the following year, with the emphasis on crew understanding their rights and everything else, you know, that's going to be a hot topic. Hi, I'm going to throw this out to you. Why do you want to talk on the podcast right now? Because obviously, you know, law firms, you kind of, like you said, stay in your lane. But why are you open to speaking on this podcast and speaking to, you know, the listeners at the moment?
I think it's really important for crew to be educated that bit more. And if we can share even just a couple of little insights that help them understand their rights or the options available if they are unsure, who to speak to, and maybe even bust some of the common misconceptions that people have about the industry, then that, you know, that, see, this seems like a great place to be able to do that and to be able to share just a couple of bits of information. There's so much competition to get jobs on board. And I think often that's then their rights and the ability to push back on a contract or the confidence to report something is missing, because they're so keen to obviously keep their job and things like that. So it's, if we can dispel some of the common misconceptions and give crew even just a couple of points to consider when they are going for roles or moving between different roles, then I think actually as women within the industry, it's incumbent upon us to share that knowledge.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's this day and age as well. You know, there is a lot more. You think even, you know, my day, like 10, 15 years ago, access to a lawyer or any legal information was more complicated. Do you know what I mean? You had to wait until you were ashore. You maybe make a phone call to any get any kind of advance kind of steering on what you should do would cost money. So I think, you know, like I said, the things are changing and I think the doors are opening up. So that's why, you know, I think it's important. And like you said, especially with women and empowering, I think it's a good time to start really understanding what you can do. And this, I mean, this is not about creating fear. You know, yachting is amazing, but empowering women and helping them make informed decisions, I think, is only a good thing for the industry as a whole. What? Like, let's maybe start at the beginning. So obviously, as far as I understand it, all crews have a contract as standard. You know, you are going to work. What would you say, let's, you know, young female, we start at the beginning of the story. What are the most important things that crews should do when it comes to going on board in regards to contracts or even asking for a contract?
Yeah, for a start, I think, yes, absolutely. You want those terms in writing. I would always say to join, you know, Nautilus or a union, because quite often they are the best first port of call for advice when things go wrong. We receive, I think, would you say, between 2 and 4, that kind of amount of inquiries from seafarers on a weekly basis when things have gone wrong. You know, that could be an incident on board, whether that's an assault, or it could be non-payment. So many different inquiries, and a lot of those are not members of a Nautilus, and if they were, it would be much more straightforward for them to get advice. The difficulty with yachting is that it is an international industry, so you've got a crew member from one country, an employer from another country, an owner from another, a boat registered in a different country, and then you're cruising in a completely different place altogether. Yeah. And yet, whilst you have your contract, and that contract will have an applicable law, which could be, you know, Cayman Islands, could be UK, could be anywhere, that only covers the certain matters that are set out in your contract. when there's an incident on board and that happens somewhere else, the first question is often determining which law and jurisdiction applies to that incident. And that is quite complicated, or can be quite complicated, and will involve a number of factors, like where the boat is, the nationalities of the people involved, if it's an incident between two people, whether there's any relationship between them. There are so many factors that come into play in determining first what law and jurisdiction apply. And depending on what law and jurisdiction apply will depend upon what happens next. So who do you report to for a start in terms of authorities rather than the onboard reporting procedure, which is separate? What rights do you have? How long would any action take? If you got a judgment, whether that would be enforceable, how you would enforce it, the costs involved. So getting that information at an early stage as to what law and jurisdiction is involved will put people on a track to getting the right advice.
With Nautil, obviously, you know, especially if you're a younger listener at the moment, from your perspective as a legal girl, because I know my perspective on what Nautilus are and what they do. From your perspective, what do Nautilus offer a crew and how does it benefit them? Just to kind of sum it up from your perspective.
From what we see, I would say it would offer them practical pointers in terms of what to do in the event that something goes wrong, but also legal support, so some legal advice, and they can step in situations where you've been accused of doing something wrong or being prosecuted and can fund some of your legal expenses. And that funding of legal expenses is really key. A lot of people in the UK, for example, working within public sectors particularly, will be members of a union, and that union will protect them in terms of advice and in terms of covering their legal costs when things do go wrong.
That's basically the reason why, like, well, with Nautilus, I've always said, you know, it's just hindsight is an amazing thing. And by the time you think of Nautilus, it's generally when something's kicked off, you know. And I know that they state themselves as a, you know, kind of a union, but I always try to explain it. It's more like having, you know, a wealth of experience in employment law behind you from the get-go. You know, they know a lot more about what can be done. But like you said, you can't do it retrospectively. And I think the importance, especially for women, every issue that you have on board is an employment issue. So unless you're an expert in employment law, most of the time, you're going to need like support. So I just think it's worth doing, you know, and like you said, in a very complicated network of, you know, accountability, you need advanced knowledge. It's not the same as obviously on land. It's quite, you know, depending on the industry, it can be quite a simple process of reporting, you know, and where you end up. Nautilus is vital to obviously when stuff goes wrong, but, you know, even when it comes to contracts and things like that, I think understanding what should be in a contract, like what your rights are and whether that really does change from Caymans to Marshall to jurisdiction. So I think having Nautilus is vital for any crew member. You say, you know, you have, you know, obviously you have calls come through quite frequently. What is, I mean, obviously you get men calling as well, but what do women generally call through? Is it just the standard contract advice? Like, do you have any information on the differences what women are calling through for you?
I think the majority of the time what we see is non-payment or termination disputes. They're really the ones that we see. I would say almost every week we have someone contact, or there's been an accident that's some form of personal injury. And I think those types of queries or those types of problems, people are more comfortable sending an email. And they very much come through, you know, whether it's through our website or they found one of our details online, they'll send an email and they'll be quite happy to give quite a lot of information in an email because it's not as personal. There's been an allegation, I did this, I didn't, but my contract's been terminated, is easier to share than some of the things that are obviously being brought out through the survey or through other experiences. And you know, when we had the discussion at the Women with Purpose lunch, those types of stories are certainly not going to be put into email correspondence simply sent. And I hope that because there are an increasing number of places people can go to speak about those types of incidents, that We might not be seeing them in our inboxes, but people are still raising them, but through other channels. But yeah, as I say, the bulk of the ones that we see is probably not as much gender specific, and it is more non-payment, termination, those types of queries.
Well, termination could be an incident that relates to what we're talking about anyway. It's one of those things that unfortunately it's difficult to talk about, but you still, like I said, it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, you had an accident and the boat's like not paying you once they've created you and you didn't realise that within your contract, to massive sexual assault on board, still got terminated because they want to try and get rid of you before there's any repercussions.
Yeah.
It's all, everything comes back to there, you know, all of it, you know, regardless of what the thing is or why you've been terminated or you've not been paid or whatever, it always comes back to employment. That's, you're probably the only anchor, excuse the pun, the crew have, you know, that's every issue is an employment law issue, really.
Yeah, it is. And you touched on the reporting lines point earlier. And yes, whilst you're in that bubble on board, it is an employment issue, or there will be employment elements. And we provide support to service users of Safer Waves. And we often are contacted by Safer Waves to say they've been approached by somebody, they have a problem, would we mind speaking to them? And we'll have a chat. And in that work, what comes out to me is that quite often, I think because of the nature of the bubble that you're living in and experiencing on board, it is very isolated. A serious incident will happen, like a serious sexual assault, for example, and people automatically think of the onboard reporting lines. But actually, that is a criminal matter, and there are agencies outside of yachting. There are the police in every country. And that's probably the best place to start in terms of reporting an incident of that nature. But people often don't even think about going to the police because the industry is such a bubble. It's almost like it just needs to be dealt with on board or within the industry. And often the work that we're doing is asking a few questions about where the incident happened, who was involved, that kind of thing, nationalities, flag, and then we're putting them in touch with the relevant agencies.
So I suppose that's, you know, that it's probably taking the bubble of on board to the, you know, they just think that they are stuck, you know, that it is only on board and you've got to go through the chain of command. And if you can't go through the chain of command, you're kind of stuck. You know, there is a distinction. I think I raised this many years ago now when we did an event in the south of France. So I had a panel come up, and what ISWAM was saying was, obviously it's a criminal offence if there's an assault or something like that. Call the, you know, either call them and they'll help you call the police and all of that kind of stuff. And then obviously, you know, they'll try and make ways to get you off board. But then Nautilus is looking at it from an employment point of perspective. And they were like, do not get off, because it makes everything harder for them. You know what I mean? Like, you need to stand your ground and kind of like, it's your employer, your space, you're the victim, you should stay on. Whereas a lot of the time with victims, they're like, get them away, get them somewhere safe if the incidents happen on board. So there's two things going on at the same time. Do you think crew are probably, like you said, it's because it is more complex, they have to start thinking there's two things to deal with at the same time, you know?
I think it's also a balance and depends on the nature of the incident and also the individual concerned, because you may have some individuals who are perfectly fine being on board, but for others, for their mental health, you've got to prioritize that. And that's where I think speaking to people like Safer Waves, who have dealt with these scenarios in numerous different configurations, is working out what is best for that individual. And it's a hard balance because they're always going to be concerned, or am I not going to be able to get another job after this? And yeah, how is that going to impact my career? I'm going to have this gap on my CV, or I'm going to, you know, have only been on board for a short amount of time. So it is a balancing act, and it's really difficult, and obviously depends on the severity of the incident and who was involved.
What's it like, as to do a bit of myth busting, what are the myths that annoy you to death, I imagine, that are still, well, it's not being peddled, but, you know, just through lack of knowledge? you know, a lot of crew believe that it's just not true.
I think maybe if something happens in international waters, then it's essentially lawless.
Pirates. It's all pirates. It's all international waters. Rules don't apply. Yeah?
Yeah.
The one that actually transcends the work that we do often is people saying, oh, but that's not how yachting works. Yeah. So we'll have a contract and it'll say one thing. And you'll say, well, okay, well, it needs to be changed because, you know, it says rotation was going to be X. Oh, no, it's fine. We just put that in the contract, but this is how it's going to be. You know, verbal salary increases and pre-rolls become permanent and they don't change it. And they just say, oh, but that's just how we do it. That's just how yachting does it. And I think if at the outset you start as a crew member doing things properly, asking, okay, if there's been a salary increase, can I have that in writing? Can I have something in writing? Just as a starter, can I have it in writing? Then as that crew member works their way up, they are going to then be spreading that positive and correct way of dealing with things. And we deal with some fantastic captains who are really on it legally. And they, you know, they look after their crew. They know what clauses need to be in their contracts. And they don't go on this very gentleman's handshake approach, which we see all the time, even in very large, you know, transactions. People are, but it's fine. We don't need to put that in the contract. And there's Jenny and I say, well, we will be putting it in the contract. So that's it. That's a common one. Doesn't matter what the contract.
Old school vibe, a gentleman's agreement. We were at Drinkers and we made this agreement. And yeah, you know, I think it's one of those things you don't like. I was shocked. I was speaking to someone the other day who, like, what happens when there's a medical incident and, like, how much the boat will pay to help you recover. And a chef thought that he had, I think, 3 months' pay. So if there was an injury he sustained at work, he had 3 months' pay at home. But there was this tiny little bit in his contract basically saying if he stays on board, but if he's repatriated, then the boat won't take any liability for any legal medical fees or anything else. He didn't even realize. So he'd signed it. He'd not been injured, but it wasn't until later on that he saw that there was like this sneaky thing. Like, yeah, if you go home, you're like going to have to rely on the NHS. The boat's not going to pay. What like little things have you seen that have just like, what are the worst things to be left out of contracts that crew are just not aware of that they should perhaps pay attention to? Apart from obviously how much they get paid and annual leave. Because I imagine that's all they focus on. How much time off am I getting? How much am I getting paid?
I think often we've seen an absence of a law and jurisdiction clause.
Explain to people.
So the law that governs the contract. So again, whether that is, you know, Spanish law, UK law, whatever. And if you don't know what law applies, how are you going to know what rights you have?
Do they have to declare that? Should they declare what laws that contract is held with?
That should be agreed in any contract, not just a crew employment contract, in any contract. You know, it's, you know, if you're entering into a B2B contract with two UK businesses, both operating in England, it's going to be pretty obvious you probably intended English law. But in this international environment, it is far from obvious what law is intended to govern the contract.
So if that's missing, does that make everything really hard?
It does make things a lot more complicated.
It means you end up having an argument about the law or trying to work out what the applicable law and jurisdiction is before you actually get into the incident or whatever has actually happened or the dispute itself.
So what's the hierarchy of that? So like where you'd go, right, it happened in such and such, or your business is based out of or registered to, is that like where you would go with it?
Yeah, all those factors will apply and it will be different if it's a civil matter. So if it's something like usually an employment dispute or a non-payment compared with if it's a negligence matter. So you weren't provided with the right safety equipment, sustained an injury, that kind of thing.
What are the jurisdictions you like and which are the ones you don't like? Like, come on, let's be honest. Like when you see someone like, oh no, they're there. Yeah. That's not good.
So we can only advise on the law of England and Wales, and anything else we have to refer to lawyers in other countries, you know, including Scotland has its own legal system. So we will send people to firms in Scotland, and internationally. We have a tried and tested network of international lawyers that we use as our go-tos.
Which is the worst one, though. The jurisdiction do not like. Like, they can be really complicated, you know, and a lot of extra costs. I imagine America's quite expensive, generally.
Definitely, yeah.
I think the other thing is, there is a reason why all of the MEBA, so Mediterranean Yacht Brokers Association contracts, whether that be for charter or for sale, are under English law. It is well established, and as much as we all might moan sometimes about court timetables, it's a lot more efficient than a lot of the courts that operate across Europe. So there's certainly a benefit, and there are quite a lot of employment rights that are in law that would help crew members, but it may not be possible to do that, and it might not be the most beneficial for them depending on where they are located. But I think the main thing is to have certainty with regards to that, because then at least you know where you're going to get advice.
Yeah.
And the worst time to read your contract is after an incident and find out that you've got Timbuktu as your law and jurisdiction, and how you're going to find a marine lawyer that you can communicate with in that jurisdiction.
Everyone's the same. You're young. You're just having a good time. I just want to get paid. I want to know how much leave I've got. That's pretty much it until you have responsibilities at home, you know? It's like one of the things that we've been talking about a while, you know, income protection, you know, which is now available for British passport holders at sea. So when the boat stops paying, hypothetically that chef, he's got his own insurance that will pay all his mortgage, pay his medical. Do you know what I mean? Like, there is stuff out there, but people only look at that stuff when they've got things. They've got a baby, they've got a mortgage. Do you know what I mean? And obviously, I'm not going to lie, you know, yachting's a young guy, girl's game. The thought of doing any kind of trip right now would terrify me beyond belief. Like, even if I was super fit, which I am not, it would still hurt a lot, you know? So yeah, it's kind of one of the things we're always battling is trying to put this in language, which, you know, younger people like understand. It's like trying to get kids to pay into a pension. It doesn't matter. You don't need to think about it. Just do it. And then by the time you realize what it is, you're laughing because you're already doing it, you know? And I think, you know, with like Nautilus again, just do it. Do you know what I mean? Just sign up while you're on board, you pay the fee, you know, and then when it all goes wrong, at least you've got somebody there, because your mum and dad are not going to understand how to fix these things at all, you know, going on. Right, let's get into contracts. So like, let's give me your hit list. What are the main things that crew need to put it in very simple language? Pretend I am 18 old. What does my contract need to have on it?
Okay, I think
apart from how much I'm getting paid,
your bare minimum. Who is your employer? Really clearly got to be stated in there. Some of these aren't very clear because they've got owner details, employer details, crew management details. You know, you need to understand who those companies are. As we've touched, I think we've killed what law applies. It's very complicated, but really that should be in there. Your salary, your leave, notice, repatriation, and sick and pay, how that's going to be dealt with. I also think you need to understand any confidentiality obligations in there as well. We obviously now, everything is shared online, and some boats won't allow you to do that. And I guess this ties into another myth that we often hear, which is that NDAs, if you sign them, mean you can't talk about anything on board, which includes any incidents, and that is not correct. And if you are asked to sign an NDA that extends beyond just keeping location and guests and any confidential information like that confidential, then you need to have it looked at, because that's not legal. So that's an interesting consideration.
It's new though, isn't it? It's a new, I mean, it was always kind of a thing. Privacy was always a thing anyway. You knew that, you know, these are basically private residences that just have to float about, you know? So privacy has always been a thing. And I'm not going to lie, I don't think it's just the NDA, it's just the fear of losing your job. You know, you knew that you were in this very private environment. You don't go shouting your mouth off, and you definitely don't take photos. But that, like you said, that there still needs to be a balance, you know, when things are going wrong, really understanding what an NDA is meant to do. Although I've got friends that tried to say stuff and have done, just like on podcasts and stuff like that. They've been contacted by lawyers to shut up because they don't want those stories to be even in vaguely, because I mean, it's not, it wouldn't be difficult to track back if you wanted to really try and find out where a story was. And I know a number of individuals that have received and contacted to say, you're saying too much. They're not even on board now. How long does an NDA last? There's a good one.
Depends what the NDA says.
Like, I worked on board, like, I don't know, 50, I can't even remember. I signed one, I had a member of the royal family on my boat once, and I signed an NDA.
If for what you're saying.
Yeah, yeah. And they contacted me, I think the last time they contacted me was like 5 years ago, to go, oh, yeah, this, do they expire? I guess they expire, because if they wanted me to just remain quiet.
It depends upon the purpose of the NDA, and it depends upon, you know, what it says. So, you know, it could be indefinite. You know, often NDAs are used in a commercial context, you know, for sale of a business, sometimes sale of a boat, and they will generally have a quite a short comparatively time limit on them. And it completely depends on the circumstances, the purpose of the NDA, and how long it says.
If someone's experienced something on board, would you say, obviously it depends on the incident, but getting off and then sorting it out, or do you stay on and try and sort it out? Because that's also another thing. You know, I know plenty of ladies that just refuse to leave until they got paid. I don't know whether that's probably sometimes the safest way about going about it. You've got to be the right kind of individual. One in particular, she's quite a feisty Latin American, so like she weren't going nowhere. Like, she literally barricaded herself. Would you say that, you know, obviously just thinking outside, should you stay on, should you stay up, get off? Like, how do you make it easier to make sure you get paid, would you say?
It does completely depend on the circumstances. And I think, you know, if you stay on board, you've got some leverage there, because quite frankly, they probably don't want you there anymore. And the easiest way to get rid of you is to pay you. But then, I think sometimes if something serious has happened, you're completely overwhelmed. You need to separate that, you know, emotional, I'm really overwhelmed right now feeling from, and ask yourself, what can I do to protect myself? Because it's not all about getting paid. Like, I would say, you know, 100% of the time, your safety is much more important than whether or not you get paid. And I think we would all say that to any, you know, family member, daughter, sister, whatever that we care about. Your safety has to come first. But what are the practical steps you can take to be safe has to be the first consideration, I would say. And then secondly, how do I, you know, get paid or get justice or get an outcome that I want as a result of this situation that has happened?
I think it's, I suppose, you know, obviously we've, you know, worked around the industry for, things have changed. Understanding the reporting procedure is probably, like I said, I think that's where we're heading now. You know, the fantastic work that Mel White's done, creating her reporting guide for Marathon for Mental Health, understanding the process. And that's one of the things with the survey, you know, women, I think things are getting better. I do think women are trying to report stuff. We're now at the point where we need to see where it's getting stuck in the process. From your perspective as lawyers, you know, what are your go-tos for reporting, you know, with advice?
So I think where to get stuck in the process is not dissimilar to where any, you know, if you're talking sexual offences, get stuck in the process when it happens on land. Those kind of offences are really difficult to prove, because if you're talking on a criminal standard in England and Wales anyway, you have to prove things beyond all reasonable doubt. That's a really high bar to meet. In terms of, there are practical things that crew can do in terms of preserving evidence, clothing, that kind of thing. But the point at which I see things get stuck, and this is through my experience of helping Safer Waves service user, is at that investigation stage. Police start an investigation, take some statements, often doesn't go any further than that. And that could be evidential, could be for evidential reasons. And a lot of the time it is, could be for public interest reasons. But that is where I see the sticking point.
I mean, the stats for rapes going to actual trial is pathetic, isn't it? Yeah. It's pretty horrendous. And yachting won't be any different, you know. I mean, technically, it might even be even harder. than on land. I suppose when it comes to incidences like that, the more people are involved, the better, you know, recording it on your behalf, getting people involved. You know, actually, if you're having a talk with a captain to report it, another person is aware of it.
Yeah. The more evidence, the better in all cases.
I think yachting adds another element of complexity because whilst people have got phones and things like that, there might be a delay in them actually taking that next step to report to police. And I think given the misconceptions we've talked about and also just not even thinking of the police starting out internally, and by that point, perhaps they've not thought about all the evidence that could have been kept or other things as well. So it adds another element of almost delay before that investigation starts. And every time you add a bit of delay, you can often then reduce the amount of evidence or the persuasiveness of that evidence.
Yeah, I mean, it just is one of those things. I mean, it's a complicated thing to kind of, you know, for people to go through. And I think especially like everything with yachting, when you're on board, it just all gets, that's hyper-focused, isn't it? You know, it's if an incident, terrible incident happens on board, the first thing you want to do is run away, I imagine, and get out of there, which, you know, it's just super complicated for women anyway, you know, and being believed. I mean, unfortunately, some of the comments that have come through from ladies that have left additional comments in the survey, you know, just not being believed and then being fired for being a troublemaker is quite common. That's one of the quite common comments that they've left. So it's a tricky one. But, you know, with, I think reporting is the way to go. Though, you know, if you are being reported or your individuals or bad practice in any form is being reported, there has to be a tipping point at some point. I do think that the industry is trying to professionalize. So with that comes, you know, you can't ignore. It's not the gentleman's handshake in the Blue Lady. Oh, you know, that was probably just a bad boat. Let's get you on board ours. I'm sure you'll be a completely different individual. It's not quite the same. What excites you about, like, obviously, you guys have branched out on your own. You've got your own company now, obviously, Entrepreneurial Women, and how that's come about. But what are you excited about to bring to the industry with Ocean Legal? What's your ethos, let's say?
So we wanted, I suppose, to create the kind of firm that we would want to instruct in the, you know, being clear on costs, being direct in terms of prospects, what you want to achieve as a result, rather than, I think, getting lost in the legal theatre that I think you often get from a lot of traditional firms.
Obviously, you're an all-female practice, yes?
Mostly, we have one consultant who works with us.
I'm going to say you're all female then. So you're all female. How tricky is it? Do you face misogyny in your industry?
Oh yeah, I think the last time we had this conversation was what, about 10 minutes before we started this podcast, with an email that Lucy received last night, was it?
Yeah.
But I think actually, you know, it forces us to be really clear about our value. It's not nice, but it's not a disadvantage. I think it makes us really disciplined and kind of makes you like build your credibility through the work that you're doing.
I like that. You know, like, I don't know if any of you guys, have you ever read the Suffragettes Manifesto?
I have.
Oh, you know, I know it's obviously women are oppressed, but it hasn't half made us raise our game. Do you know what I mean? Like, women can be very stubborn and determined. And without those obstacles, a lot, you know, if women wouldn't have raised their game if you just gave it to them. I think that's one of the things I've got an episode coming up talking about feminism. Am I a feminist or not? I don't think you should just get a job because you've got a vagina. You know, it shouldn't be the ultimate qualification. But I do... I've got, you know, maybe it's because I'm a Western woman sitting in England, and I'm like, God, the struggle is actually, you know, you got to want it. Anything that's worth something, you have to fight, or you have to learn, or you have to be dedicated to do it, because, you know, otherwise it's not worth anything. And I think, you know, I think we're coming to a bit of a reckoning in the UK, especially with stereotypical industries like yourselves, you know, like law, you know, look into the city, finance, same thing. I mean, it's a tricky one to break into, but you've got to be at the top of your game. I just wish maybe our chancellor was maybe a little bit per game. Just a little bit higher. Don't cry in front of them. Don't give them the satisfaction. Don't do it. Do you think it's kind of, you know, you're more confident? Just what are the advantages of being female with being a lawyer at the moment?
I think you're seeing more and more female lawyers in this field, to be fair, which is obviously great. I think it's brilliant. I mean, Jenny and I have always worked well together, but I think there's more of an openness and an ability to be human, which sometimes our male counterparts strip out, you know, and I think that's a big difference. And luckily enough, I think it's becoming rarer that we're getting these types of comments, but it does take an extra amount of confidence when we are going to events, and when I'm dealing with predominantly all male brokers, a lot of male lawyers on the other side, you know, a lot of captains. It is predominantly male, and you have to build that confidence in yourself to be able to have all those discussions on a daily basis. And be challenged and try and see it as just a challenge on what you're saying as opposed to who's saying it.
Yeah. I mean, the industry is, you know, it is what it is. You know, I don't expect it to be female dominated anytime soon. But there is, you know, there are advantages from the female perspective. And like you said, not all of it is just the letter of the law. There is more human elements. And with doing the survey, myself and the reporting changing and stuff like that, I do hope that we can get to a point where people are held accountable for their actions. And those cases, you will need a human element. They're not cases where you can kind of go at it just matter-of-factly. It will be quite a delicate one. So I'm quite enthusiastic, you know, with hopefully we're heading towards raising standards across the board and how women are treated across the board, and knowing that if there are any complete, utter arseholes out there, we've got people like you that can actually go, right, let's try and see if we can get this one. Because it will, you know, to prevent bad things from happening, it is a team effort. Like what we said earlier, a lot of cases don't get anywhere on land, let alone at sea in multiple jurisdictions. Do you think that's possible? Can you give me hope for the future that if a case came about, you know, I know of a couple that, you know, 10, 15 women coming forward to try and get somebody who doesn't deserve in the industry to be out. Do you think we've got hope for the future?
I think there's hope. I don't think that the hope necessarily comes from the criminal justice system.
So it's more weeding out type thing.
Yeah, but I think there could be a different way of upholding standards in the industry, and that's something that could be explored a bit further.
You have to be clever about it.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm super excited to crack on with all of this stuff, especially now I've got some lawyers in my back pocket.
But one good one is, it's really interesting and looking forward to seeing the results and what happens next.
Yeah, it's going to be an eye-opener for everybody. I would love your analysis as well. Because the ultimate aim to this is, like I said, I do believe that there is, because we have got a time on the survey, so when you worked in the industry and whether that's changed. I do think more women are coming forward and reporting, but there's massive gaping holes in the reporting procedure on board. So then it's the next conversation, proper HR, proper management, which leans into employment law again. So, you know, there's definitely some great conversations to be had in the foreseeable future. But thank you for coming on. I really appreciate you giving us some time. We'll probably maybe get you back to talk about some specific issues in the future if you guys are up for it, just to kind of, I think it's nice to have these conversations out loud, you know.
And the education side is hopefully going to add to fewer incidents, or if an incident occurs, someone being better supported, because I think that's one of the big changes we'll see. Maybe there are still incidents happening, but hopefully the people aren't feeling that they need to stay quiet, or they're not knowing where to go. You look online now, there are numerous places to help. And hopefully, if the really unfortunate event does happen, there is support there quicker.
Yeah. I mean, and like I said, everything's changing so fast, you know, with the introduction of AI, lots of things are happening all at the same time. So yeah, I'm on that ride. And like I said, it's just really nice to have some lawyers that we can obviously we'll refer back to you guys when new things come on the horizon. But anyway, thank you so much for your time. I hope the listeners have enjoyed it, and we will get you on again. So thank you so much, ladies, for joining me.
Thank you.
Dear listeners, if you've enjoyed this episode, I've got a whole bunch more coming. If you've got questions or anything else, please send them through. We can put them on to the ladies and they can answer any questions that you've got. But until next time, take care and we'll speak again soon.